2020 by at least half by capturing opportunities to increase energy productivity, the level of output we achieve from the energy we consume. So much of this involves just being smarter about how we design buildings, packages, vehicles, refrigerators, air conditioners, and lighting systems, and constantly insisting on higher and higher standards of efficiency from each of them, so we get the same comfort, mobility, and illumination from fewer resources. So, before the combination of hot, flat, and crowded forces us to shrink our economic growth, bake a smaller pie, and divide up the smaller pieces, we need to take our very best shot at building a bigger, more sustainable pie pan through innovation around clean electrons and energy efficiency. Before we resign ourselves to a world of scarcity and imposed limitations, which is the world our children will inherit if we just stay with business as usual, we need to do everything we can, as Jim Rogers, the president and CEO of Duke Energy, argues, to expand the world of possibilities by driving all forms of innovation. I don't want to be the first generation telling my kids, "You can't have a life as good as I did," said K.R. Sridhar, the Indian-American fuel cell inventor and founder of Bloom Energy. Let someone else say that. I am going to die trying to invent our way out of this. An ethic of conservation. While building this new system based on innovation of clean electrons and improved energy and resource efficiency, we can't ignore conservation. This is not just an afterthought. This piece of the system is as important as the first two. An ethic of conservation is essential today, and it is going to be even more so tomorrow, especially if we do invent a source of abundant, clean, reliable, cheap electrons. Why? Because one thing we absolutely know from the dirty fuel system is that when things are free or cheap, air, water, land, forests, fisheries, gasoline, electrons, people abuse and overuse them. Without an ethic of conservation, a deeply ingrained habit of always looking to minimize our impact on the natural world, the availability of abundant, clean, reliable, cheap electrons would turn into a license to rape our natural world. If energy is abundant, clean, reliable, and cheap, then why not buy a Hummer and drive it through the rainforest? What constitutes an ethic of conservation? We can start to answer that question by saying what ethics are not. Ethics are not laws. They are not imposed by the state. Rather, they are norms, values, beliefs, habits, and attitudes that are embraced voluntarily, that we as a society impose on ourselves. Laws regulate behavior from the outside in. Ethics regulate behavior from the inside out. Ethics are something you carry with you wherever you go to guide whatever you do. An ethic of conservation, explains Michael J. Sandel, a political philosopher at Harvard, would embrace several norms, beginning with a sense of responsibility, a sense of stewardship for the natural world. An ethic of conservation, said Sandel, is an ethic of restraint that says we have a responsibility to preserve the Earth's resources and natural wonders in and of themselves, because they constitute the very web of life on which all living creatures on this planet depend. But in addition to a sense of stewardship toward the natural world, an ethic of conservation also has to include a spirit of trusteeship, argued Sandel. Stewardship involves responsibility for the natural world. It is born of wonder and awe for the diversity of life and the majesty of nature. Trusteeship involves responsibility for future generations, for those who will inhabit this place after our time. It is a form of solidarity with our children and grandchildren, said Sandel. An ethic of conservation requires both stewardship and trusteeship, habits of restraint that express respect for the earth that we inhabit, and respect for future generations. To become good stewards and good trustees, added Sandel, we will need to rein in our tendency to regard the earth and its natural resources as wholly at our disposal for present needs, wants, and desires. We have to develop new habits and attitudes toward consumption. Otherwise, whatever technologies we devise will simply be used to extend our current habits of profligate consumption to the huge, burgeoning middle classes of a hot, flat, and crowded world. Does this mean that America or the world economy should stop growing? Does it mean that we, as individuals, have to edit our lifestyles down to a bare minimum or get by with much less than the average American upper or middle class family consumes today? There is an anti-capitalist, anti-consumerist, back-to-nature wing of the environmental movement that believes we should and almost delights in advocating that. By the way, that may be right and should not be dismissed. My point is that we don't know yet, because we have not tried even the obvious stuff that we do know would have real effects and would not involve fundamental changes in our lifestyle. Telling every individual on the planet who wants or can afford a car that they cannot have one would be changing our lifestyle. But banning cars over a certain weight or engine size, or bringing maximum speed limits back down to 55 miles per hour, or banning taxis that are not hybrids, such efforts do not strike me as fundamentally cramping anyone's lifestyle. Telling people that henceforth we are going to ration electricity, you can have only so much per month, would certainly involve changing our lifestyle. But making it illegal for office buildings in America to leave their lights on after hours, as tens of thousands of companies mindlessly seem to do, as you can see by driving through any major city after midnight, does not strike me as fundamentally cramping anyone's lifestyle. Telling people that they cannot have an iPod or laptop would certainly involve changing our lifestyle, but requiring all iPods and laptops to be made with easily recyclable materials doesn't strike me as fundamentally cramping anyone's lifestyle. Telling people they cannot live in anything more than a 5,000 square foot space would certainly involve changing our lifestyle, in the developed world at least, but telling anyone who wants to live in a more than 5,000 square foot home that they can do so only if the home is energy net zero, only if it generates through solar, wind, or geothermal power as much clean energy as it uses, doesn't strike me as fundamentally cramping anyone's lifestyle. Forcing everyone to ride a bike to work would involve changing our lifestyle. But requiring municipalities to set aside bike lanes running from suburbs to inner cities doesn't strike me as cramping anyone's lifestyle, and might make our whole society healthier. Implementing congestion pricing in every major downtown in America, as London and Singapore have done, could involve some lifestyle changes, but if it were accompanied by big new investments in mass transit, not only might we not be worse off, we might actually be better off. In the last year, I have started to take the Washington area subway to work more regularly instead of driving myself. I get there just as fast, or even faster. I breeze through two newspapers along the way, and I arrive at work feeling less stressed. A lot of people in a lot of countries might actually enjoy giving up some personal mobility if their governments spent more money on mass transit and less on subsidizing gasoline. In sum, we don't know how many millions of barrels of oil or kilowatts of energy we could save just by thinking more about how we live rather than shrinking more of how we live. We don't know how many millions of barrels of oil or kilowatts of energy we could save if and when people discover that green is better, not harsher, and offers more, not less. As I indicated, it may be that a radical change in lifestyle is all that can save us and the planet. I would not rule it out. But we don't know whether we'll need to opt for the drastic because we haven't yet tried the obvious. Conservation is not the opposite of consumption, argues Glenn Prickett of Conservation International. We need to consume to live and to grow our economies. But we can consume more and conserve more at the same time. We need to identify those places and resources that we need to preserve in their natural state and grow around them. And we need to identify the practices that are just wasteful, out of habit or ignorance, not necessity or design, and eliminate them. There is still plenty of room for conservation and consumption if we are smart, properly plan, and are vigilant about protecting what we have set aside, said Prickett. People on both sides of the energy environment debate often confuse this issue. Too many environmentalists oppose any growth, a position that locks the poor into poverty. Too many critics of environmentalism characterize any conservation as some flaky anti-capitalist ideological dalliance. They fail to recognize how important nature, clean water, clean air, healthy forests, healthy oceans, and species diversity is to our daily life and our spiritual well-being, not to mention our economy and how vulnerable it is to destruction. Not every acre of land or sea has to be protected, says Prickett, but the ones that do warrant protection are the ones that provide the critical ecological life support systems, because they harbor endangered species, because they protect watersheds, because they buffer streams and keep sediment and nutrients out of rivers, because they are breeding grounds for the fish we eat, because they keep CO2 out of the atmosphere, because they maintain species diversity that makes larger landscapes more resilient to climate change, and, ultimately, because nature provides a spiritual richness to life that is an essential part of being human. Therefore, we need a clean energy system that is always trying to optimize three things at once: innovation and generation of the cleanest and cheapest electrons, the most efficient and productive use of those electrons and other natural resources, and constant attention to protecting and conserving our natural systems and educating people about their material, spiritual, and aesthetic value. The more clean electrons we generate, the more growth we can have with fewer emissions. The greater the energy efficiency we bring about, the fewer clean electrons we need to get more growth. The more conservation we promote, the fewer clean electrons and the less energy efficiency we need, and the fewer natural resources we consume as we grow. There are people who believe that unlimited cheap energy is a recipe for disaster in the long run, said Peter Gleick, the climate expert at the Pacific Institute. But in the short run, our problem is not having enough clean energy. That is much more dangerous to us right now because of the threat of climate change. But in the long run, we do have to think about the implications of cheap. Señor Verde, let's fantasize for a moment and ask, what would an ideal farm in Brazil that was operating as part of such a clean energy system look like? Imagine Señor Verde has a 1,000-acre farm with a river full of fish running through it that is adjacent to an expanse of natural forest loaded with a rich diversity of plants and animals. Here is how he would operate. He would start his day using a smart tractor, the kind already made by John Deere. As he plows his field, the tractor takes real-time measurements of the moisture and nutrient content of each square meter and automatically inserts only the exact amount of fertilizer needed to produce the yield he seeks. That way, there is no fertilizer left over to wash into his river and harm the aquatic life there and downstream. Less nitrogen fertilizer also means fewer emissions of nitrogen oxide, a potent greenhouse gas. Thanks to this technology, he is taking advantage all the time of the most productive parts of his land for farming. So, he has less incentive to go into the rainforest or to denude the riverbanks of trees just to plant a few more acres of crops. In fact, he and his neighbors have worked with a local conservation NGO to zone their farms so that the most productive areas are farmed and other areas are set aside and restored to their native vegetation, which protects the streams and allows wildlife to migrate across a much larger area of natural habitat. That smart tractor, by the way, is a plug-in electric hybrid with a backup motor that runs on biofuel made from switchgrass planted in Brazil on degraded lands that were specifically set aside as part of a national plan to protect the Amazon from biofuel encroachment. All the information amassed about the amount of fertilizer that went into every square meter of his land and the yield it ultimately produced is captured on the onboard computer so he can make smarter decisions next year and increase his yield, even as he reduces his inputs. The sprinkler system is also a smart system and adds only the precise amount of water per square meter that is needed. The crop itself has been engineered to grow with the least amount of fertilizer and the least amount of water and fewest pesticides, so it is much stronger and produces a higher yield than non-bioengineered crops. It has also been engineered to be more nutritious, so people get healthier and healthier from less and less food. In addition, because he is using fewer and cleaner fertilizers, the impact on the local river is tiny, so the water can be recycled with less energy and fewer chemicals. Also, by not cultivating the banks of the river and by maintaining the trees, he is preserving from erosion his most valuable asset, the arable land that produces his crops, and providing through the roots of trees and wetlands a natural water filter, which keeps sediment out of the river and prevents degradation of the wetlands downstream. Because the river is healthy, he can enjoy fishing it or swimming in it much more, but he can also license others to come and fish for peacock bass on it each summer, making another nice little side income. On the part of his land that abuts the tropical forest, he has built a small eco-lodge, which draws all its electricity from a 1-megawatt wind turbine and attracts hundreds of eco-tourists each year. Finally, the government allowed Señor Verde to build the eco-lodge on the condition that he protect the surrounding rainforest on his land and fund the protection of a nearby national park. It made sense to him to fund the park because he is protecting the habitat for bees that pollinate his crops and other insects that prey on his pests, enabling him to buy even fewer expensive chemical pesticides, and the virgin forest also provides a more reliable water supply for his farm by protecting the watershed, which becomes more important as climate change threatens more drought, and provides habitat for the wildlife that his eco-tourists pay him to see. The net result is an ecosystem that is much healthier, more enjoyable, and more productive than the one we have now. All the parts reinforce one another, thereby producing more agricultural growth, protecting more biodiversity, and generating more clean power and efficiency savings with fewer, cleaner, smarter inputs. This is the ideal we need to be striving for. Making the transition. So, how do we get there from here? How do we get from the dirty fuel system we have now to a clean-powered, energy-efficient, conservation-based system? We need to think strategically about how to build every part of the system. We need to start with a plan for the whole, instead of offering one-off projects without any strategic blueprint, the way we did with the massive subsidization of corn ethanol production in the United States. Or as Egypt's Minister of Trade and Industry, Rashid M. Rashid, said to me the moment I sat down to interview him in January 2008, "What are you guys doing? The average Egyptian family's food bill takes up about 60% of their total budget. We are the biggest importers of wheat in the world, 6 million tons a year." So many American farmers were planting corn for ethanol in place of wheat that the price of wheat had gone up from $180 a ton at the end of 2006 to $390 a ton at the end of 2007. It is a disaster. It is not over, and the major reason is U.S. subsidies for biofuels, said Rashid. I tell you, poor Egyptians hate biofuels. They don't know much about them, but they hate them. Given the small net energy and CO2 contribution made by corn ethanol, the whole craze reminds me of the late economist Ken Bolding's definition of suboptimal. Doing the best possible job at something that should not be done at all. What would a more systemic approach look like? Google gave us one example. In November 2007, the giant web search company announced that it would no longer just offer power searching, but was itself going to be searching for power. Clean power from non-fossil fuel sources. Yes, Google said, it was going into the energy innovation and generation business with the aim of producing 1 gigawatt of clean renewable power, enough to run all of San Francisco as soon as possible. It is a daring effort, and Google should be commended for putting its capital and brains behind such an initiative. I have only one tiny problem with it. Google summarized its revolutionary goal in a single shorthand equation. RE is less than C, renewable energy cheaper than coal, so that this clean energy can scale in China, India, and the rest of the developing world. It is true that renewable energy that is cheaper than coal is necessary, but as I have argued, it is not sufficient. We also need innovation to improve energy and resource productivity, and we need an ethic of conservation without which RE is less than C could wipe out massive amounts of biodiversity. Google's heart is in the right place. We need a bumper sticker that summarizes our objective in a focused manner. I would simply propose a longer bumper sticker. In fact, my bumper sticker might take up your whole bumper. With tongue only slightly in cheek, I would argue that what we need is an REEFIGDCPEERPC is less than TTCOBCOG. A renewable energy ecosystem for innovating, generating, and deploying clean power, energy efficiency, resource productivity, and conservation is less than the true cost of burning coal, oil, and gas. That is, we need clean energy that is cheaper than the true cost to society of fossil fuels. When you measure the climate change those fuels cause, the pollution they trigger, and the energy wars they engender. In my view, moving to Code Green means putting in place a system of government policies, regulations, research funding, and tax incentives that would stimulate a system for innovating, generating, and deploying clean electrons, energy efficiency, and resource productivity along with an ethic of conservation. It takes a systemic approach to produce a systemic response. That has to be our strategy. But there are no shortcuts. We need to replace the dirty fuel system with a clean energy system, and REEFIGDCPEERPC is less than TTCOBCOG. And in politics and economics, there is a simple term that describes the process of replacing one system with another. Revolution. Some people say that is what we're having right now, a green revolution. I beg to differ. Part 3. How We Move Forward. Chapter 9. 205 Easy Ways to Save the Earth. Oh God, here they come. Act green. A husband and wife speaking as another couple approaches them at a cocktail party. Cartoon in the New Yorker, August 20th, 2007. A recent study found the average American golfer walks about 900 miles a year. Another study found American golfers drink, on average, 22 gallons of alcohol a year. That means, on average, American golfers get about 41 miles to the gallon. Kinda makes you proud. From the Internet. What do you mean? We're not having a green revolution? But I just picked up Working Mother magazine at the doctor's office and read the cover story. 205 Easy Ways to Save the Earth, November 2007. It so whetted my appetite for easy ways to save the planet that I Googled for more books and magazine articles on this topic, and boy did I find more. 20 Easy Ways You Can Help the Earth. Easy Ways to Protect Our Planet. Simple Ways to Save the Earth. 10 Ways to Save the Earth. 20 Quick and Easy Ways to Save the Planet. 5 Ways to Save the Earth. The 10 Easiest Ways to Green Your Home. 365 Ways to Save the Earth. 100 Ways You Can Save the Earth. 1001 Ways to Save the Earth. 101 Ways to Heal the Earth. 10 Painless Ways to Save the Planet. 21 Ways to Save the Earth and Make More Money. 14 Easy Ways to Be an Everyday Environmentalist. Easy Ways to Go Green. 40 Easy Ways to Save the Planet. 10 Simple Ways to Save the Earth. Help Save the Planet. Easy Ways to Make a Difference. 50 Ways to Save the Earth. 50 Simple Ways to Save the Earth and Get Rich Trying. Top 10 Ways to Green Up Your Sex Life. Vegan condoms, solar vibrators, I'm not making this up. Innovative ways to save planet Earth. 101 things designers can do to save the Earth. 5 weird and wacky ways to save the Earth. 5 ways to save the world. And for those with a messianic streak, but who are short of both cash and time, 10 ways to save the Earth and money in under a minute. Who knew that saving the Earth could be so easy, and in under a minute? There is some good news in this trend. Thinking about how to live and work in a greener fashion, with cleaner electrons, greater energy and resource productivity, and an ethic of conservation, is being popularized and democratized. It is no longer an elite issue for those living on the West and East Coasts, or in the backwoods of Colorado or Vermont. If you are in the technology business today and you have not been invited to a green tech conference somewhere, you must not be breathing. or everybody has lost your email address. To say that green is the color du jour is an understatement. Green was actually the single most trademarked term in 2007, according to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. Environmental reporters in newsrooms, who used to sit in the corner farthest from the editor's desk, are suddenly cool. Universities are adding classes on environmentalism and looking to shrink their carbon footprints, as are more and more companies. No candidate can get elected today without uttering the trilogy, "I will support cleaner fuels. I will liberate America from its oil dependence. I will combat climate change." The politics of this issue have shifted so much that even Al-Qaeda supporters, who always have their fingers on the global pulse, are getting in on the green branding thing. Newsweek, September 10, 2007, reported that in July 2007, an umbrella group of Islamists that advocates a Sharia state in Indonesia, and whose leaders have publicly supported Osama bin Laden, hoisted placards bearing the name Friends of the Earth Indonesia at a rally protesting a U.S. mining company and the Bush administration. The real Friends of the Earth denounced the unauthorized use of their logo and denied any links. But don't be surprised if radical Islamists make more attempts to cloak their work in the garb of social activism. Not to be outdone by the Muslims, the Jews are also getting in on the act. UPI reported, December 5, 2007, a group of Israeli environmentalists has launched an internet campaign encouraging Jews around the world to light at least one fewer candle this Hanukkah. The founders of the Green Hanukkah campaign say each candle burning all the way down produces 15 grams of carbon dioxide. And that many candles multiplied around Jewish households all over the world starts to add up to a kosher carbon footprint. The campaign calls for Jews around the world to save the last candle and save the planet, so we won't need another miracle. Liad Ortar, a founder of the campaign, told the Jerusalem Post. One blog I saw said in response, "Why not ask everyone in the world to stop smoking cigarettes?" You'll pardon me, though, if I've become a bit cynical about all of this. I have read or heard so many people saying, "We're having a green revolution." Of course, there is certainly a lot of green buzz out there, but whenever I hear that "we're having a green revolution" line, I can't resist firing back, "Really? Really? A green revolution? Have you ever seen a revolution where no one got hurt? That's the green revolution we're having. In the green revolution we're having, everyone's a winner. Nobody has to give up anything." And the adjective that most often modifies green revolution is easy. That's not a revolution. That's a party. We're actually having a green party. And I have to say, it's a lot of fun. I get invited to all the parties, but in America, at least, it is mostly a costume party. It's all about looking green, and everyone's a winner. There are no losers. The American farmers are winners. They're green. They get to grow ethanol and garner huge government subsidies for doing so, even though it makes no real sense as a CO2 reduction strategy. ExxonMobil says it's getting green, and General Motors does too. GM put yellow gas caps on its cars that are flex fuel, meaning they can run on a mix of gasoline and ethanol. For years, GM never bothered to highlight that its cars were flex fuel or use it as a selling point with customers because the only reason GM made a certain number of cars flex fuel was that, if it did so, the government would allow it to build even more gas-guzzling Hummers and pickup trucks and still remain under the CAFE fuel economy standard mandated by Congress. But why quibble? Coal companies are going green by renaming themselves energy companies and stressing how sequestration of CO2 something none of them has ever done, will give us clean coal. I am sure Dick Cheney is green. He has a home in Wyoming where he goes hunting, and he favors liquefied coal. We're all green. Yes, step right up, ladies and gentlemen. In the green revolution we're having in America today, everybody gets to play, everybody's a winner, nobody gets hurt, and nobody has to do anything hard. As I said, that's not the definition of a revolution. That's the definition of a party. Thankfully, more than a few people are on to this green party. A blogger at greenasathistle.com, which tracks environmental issues, wryly observed, "Raising awareness about global warming, enviro-friendly products, and people doing green deeds is obviously a good thing, but does every single magazine on the rack have to come out with a green issue? I'm starting to believe that there actually can be too much publicity when it comes to climate change, especially when it reaches the fashion world. Seriously, if I read the word eco-chic one more time, I'll jab my eyes out with my biodegradable pen. I just fear that as soon as all the magazines get these green issues out of the way, they'll feel like it's out of their system, over and done with, like any other passing trend. By next month, they'll probably declare gas guzzling in and earnest recycling out, with headlines like, "Littering is the new black." The amount of time, energy, and verbiage being spent on making people aware of the energy climate problem and asking people to make symbolic gestures to call attention to it is out of all proportion to the time, energy, and effort going into designing a systemic solution. We've had too many Live Earth concerts and Barney's Have a Green Holiday Christmas catalogs and too few focused lobbying efforts to enact transformational green legislation. If the money and mobilization efforts spent on Live Earth had gone into lobbying the U.S. Congress for more generous and longer-term production and investment tax credits for renewable energy and for other green legislation, the impact would have been vastly more meaningful. Moving from the symbolic to the substantive is not easy. I live in Montgomery County, Maryland, which is chock full of people who identify themselves as green and recycle and do all the other good things. But when I wanted to install 2 solar arrays in my side yard, I was told that it was against the law. Too unsightly. Zoning laws said they could go only in the backyard. Our backyard doesn't get enough sun. Our solar firm had to hire a lawyer and appeal to get the law changed, which we managed to do after almost a year. Pentagon planners like to say, a vision without resources is a hallucination. Right now, we are having a green hallucination, not a green revolution, because we are offering ourselves and our kids a green vision without the resources, without a systemic response shaped by an intelligent design and buttressed by market forces, higher efficiency standards, tougher regulations, and an ethic of conservation that might have a chance of turning that vision into reality. We have willed the ends, but not the means. Sure, if you look at how far we have come in just the last 5 years, it can feel like we're having a green revolution. But if you look at where we have to go in the next 10 years, we're having a party. No one has said it better than Michael Maniates, a professor of political science and environmental science at Allegheny College, who wrote in the Washington Post, November 22, 2007, "Never has so little been asked of so many at such a critical moment." Several best-selling books offer advice about what we must ask of ourselves and one another, Maniates noted. Their titles suggest that we needn't break much of a sweat. it's easy being green, the lazy environmentalist, or even the Green Book, the everyday guide to saving the planet one simple step at a time. Although each offers familiar advice, reuse scrap paper before recycling, or take shorter showers, it's what's left unsaid by these books that's intriguing. Three assertions permeate the pages. 1. We should look for easy, cost-effective things to do in our private lives as consumers, since that's where we have the most power and control. These are the best things to do because, 2. If we all do them, the cumulative effect of these individual choices will be a safe planet. Which is fortunate indeed because, 3. We, by nature, aren't terribly interested in doing anything that isn't private, individualistic, cost-effective, and, above all, easy. This glorification of easy isn't limited to the newest environmental self-help books. The websites of the big U.S. environmental groups, the Environmental Protection Agency, and even the American Association for the Advancement of Science offer markedly similar lists of actions that tell us we can change the world through our consumer choices, choices that are economic, simple, even stylish. Of course, we are not going to consume our way out of this problem, and there is no easy button we can press to make the world green. Maniates went on, "The hard facts are these. If we sum up the easy, cost-effective, eco-efficiency measures we should all embrace, the best we get is a slowing of the growth of environmental damage. Obsessing over recycling and installing a few special light bulbs won't cut it. We need to be looking at fundamental change in our energy, transportation, and agricultural systems rather than technological tweaking on the margins. And this means changes and costs that our current and would-be leaders seem afraid to discuss. Which is a pity, since Americans are at their best when they're struggling together and sometimes with one another toward difficult goals. Surely we must do the easy things. They slow the damage and themselves become enabling symbols of empathy for future generations. But we cannot permit our leaders to sell us short. To stop at easy is to say that the best we can do is accept an uninspired politics of guilt around a parade of uncoordinated individual action. The problem is, the minute we leave the comforting realm of the easy ways to go green, whatever facile consensus for action exists around this issue breaks down. The truth is, for all that we talk about going green, we have not agreed as a society on what being green actually means, remarked Peter Gleick, the climate expert from the Pacific Institute. That opens a door to everyone claiming to be green without any benchmarks. What I hope to do in the remainder of this program is lay out what a systemic green strategy would look like. But before we go there, we need to stop for just one moment at the weight scale. You know how after you put on a few pounds, you stop weighing yourself, or at least I do, because you just don't want to know how many pounds you are going to have to shed? Well, the same has been true of the green issue. People tend to talk about it in the total abstract, without any connection to the actual scale of the challenge we have to meet in order to significantly reduce CO2 emissions and become more energy and resource efficient. So before we take another step, we need to put this challenge on the scale, look down at the digital readout, and behold, without blinking, just how big a project this really is. For starters, let's remember what we're trying to do. We're trying to change the climate system to avoid the unmanageable and manage the unavoidable. We are trying to affect how much the rain falls, how strong the winds blow, how fast the ice melts. In addition to all that, we're trying to preserve and restore the world's rapidly depleting ecosystems, our forests, rivers, savannas, oceans, and the cornucopia of plant and animal species they contain. Finally, we are trying to break a collective addiction to gasoline that is having not only profound climate effects, but also geopolitical ones. It doesn't get any bigger than this. This is not something you do as a hobby, and the adjective easy should never, ever, ever accompany this task. The truth is, not only are there not 205 easy ways to really go green, there isn't one easy way to really go green. If we can pull this off, it will be the biggest single peacetime project humankind will have ever undertaken. Rare is the political leader anywhere in the world who will talk straight about the true size of this challenge. As a result, the task often falls to oil, gas, and coal company executives. They are happy to tell us about the scale of the problem, but usually with secret delight, because they want us to believe that a real green revolution is impossible to pull off, so we have no choice but to remain addicted to oil, gas, and coal. They want to break our will to resist. Their hidden message is, surrender now. Give in to your inner gas guzzler. The scale of what we need to do to really make a difference is too great. Surrender now. Surrender now. Surrender now. I am instinctively wary of their analysis, but I do make exceptions for companies that have actually made substantial bets in renewable energy and are actually looking to build real businesses there, if there is a market. Chevron, for instance, is the world's biggest private producer of electricity from clean geothermal sources, steam, heat, and hot water produced underground by volcanic material from the Earth's core, which provides the force to spin turbine generators and produce electricity. Here's how Chevron's CEO, David O'Reilly, sees the scope and scale of our clean energy challenge. There is a problem with energy literacy, O'Reilly argues. If you look at energy consumption in the world each day and convert it all into oil equivalent, we are consuming 10 million barrels an hour. That is 420 million gallons per hour. Think about that. That means if we take all the hydro, coal, oil, and renewables, everything, and put them together, that is how much we are using. To really make a difference, there are three issues. There is the scale of the demand, the scale of the investment needed to produce alternatives at scale, and the scale of time it takes to produce alternatives. Many alternatives are just at the embryonic phase. Now let's look at the rising demand. I've heard people talk about the golden billion, the billion people on the planet who already have the quality of life and standard of living we Americans are used to. But there are another 2 billion on the way up and 3 billion still in poverty. The 2 billion who are moving up want to get to where we are, and then the 3 billion want to move up, and from a global prosperity point of view, we want them to move up. Then there's another 3 billion coming along who have not even been born yet, but will be here by 2050. The energy supply we have today is focused on meeting the demands of the 1 billion and the 2 billion, not the 3 billion who are still in poverty, let alone the 3 billion who have not been born yet. So this 10 million barrels per hour that we are consuming is not static, said O'Reilly. It is going to rise because there is an inexorable connection between energy use and well-being. Now, said O'Reilly, let's look at the challenge of creating new ways to produce and use energy. People are overestimating the ability of the alternatives that are out there to get to scale, he explained. Let's talk about efficiency. If you shut down the whole transportation system, I am talking about every car, truck, train, ship, and plane, anything that flies or is on wheels, and another vehicle never moved on planet Earth, you would reduce carbon emission by 14% globally. If you shut down all industrial activity, all commercial activity, all residential activity, shut everything off to every home, you would reduce carbon emissions by 68%. So efficiency can help, but let's not make false promises. We still need oil and natural gas. We need to make coal work, and we need to make energy efficiency work more. As if that scenario doesn't already boggle the mind, O'Reilly argues that, absent some unexpected breakthrough, it will take decades for alternatives to be brought to scale. I want my grandchildren to live in a world that has energy, environment, and economy in balance. But you cannot get there overnight, he insisted. The system we have today is the product of over 100 years of investments, and the next one will require 100 years of investments. So, these quick promises that we hear in Washington and other places, be careful. My prediction is that global greenhouse gases will be higher 10 years from now than they are today, but when my grandchildren are in my stage of life, their 60s, they could be substantially lower. We need leaders who will stand up and say, this is hard, this is big, and it requires massive amounts of investment. What about the $5 billion or so that I keep reading about that went into green venture capital investing in 2007? I asked O'Reilly. That would not even buy a sophisticated new oil refinery, he snapped. If you want to really change the path we are on, you need a number that starts with a T in front of it. T for trillion. Otherwise, we will stay on the path we are on. But let's say you are an optimist. You believe that the renewable energy technologies available today and opportunities for energy efficiency are advanced enough to make a fundamental impact on both climate change and energy prices. What exactly would we have to do by way of deploying these existing clean power technologies and energy efficiency programs starting today to make that fundamental impact? The answer to that question, and another way to look at the scale of the problem, is offered by Robert Sokolow, an engineering professor at Princeton, and Stephen Pakala, an ecology professor there, who together lead the Carbon Mitigation Initiative, a consortium that has set out to design scalable solutions for the climate problem. Sokolow and Pakala first argued in a now-famous paper published by the journal Science, August 2004, that human beings can emit only so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere before the buildup of CO2 reaches a level unknown in recent geologic history, and the Earth's climate system starts to go haywire. Like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they argued that the risk of really weird global weirding grows rapidly as CO2 levels approach a doubling of the concentration of CO2 that was in the atmosphere before the Industrial Revolution, which was 280 parts per million. Think of the climate change issue as a closet, and behind the door are lurking all kinds of monsters, and there's a long list of them, Pakala said. All of our scientific work says the most damaging monsters start to come out from behind that door when you hit the doubling of CO2 levels. So, as a simple goal everyone can understand, the doubling of CO2 is what we want to avoid. Here's the problem. If we basically do nothing, and global CO2 emissions continue to grow at the current trajectory, we will easily pass the doubling level an atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide of 560 parts per million around mid-century, and will likely hit a tripling sometime around 2075, said Pakala. You don't want to live in a 560 parts per million world, let alone an 800 parts per million world. To avoid that, and still leave room for developed countries to grow while using less carbon, and for developing countries like India and China to grow, emitting double or triple their current carbon levels until they climb out of poverty and are able to become more energy efficient, will require a huge global industrial energy project. To convey the scale involved, Sokolo and Pakala created a pie chart with 15 different wedges. Some wedges represent carbon-free or carbon-diminishing power-generating technologies. Other wedges represent efficiency programs that could conserve large amounts of energy and prevent CO2 emissions. Sokolo and Pakala argue that beginning today, right now, the world needs to deploy any 8 of these 15 wedges on a grand scale, or sufficient amounts of all 15 in order to generate enough clean power, conservation, and energy efficiency to grow the world economy and still avoid the doubling of CO2 in the atmosphere by mid-century. Each of these wedges, when phased in over 50 years, would avoid the release of 25 billion tons of carbon, for a total of 200 billion tons of carbon avoided between now and mid-century, which is the amount that Pakala and Sokolo believe would keep us below the doubling. To qualify as one of the 15 wedges, though, the technology must exist today and must be capable of large-scale deployment, and the emissions reductions it offers have to be measurable. So now we have a target. We want to avoid the doubling of CO2 by mid-century, and to do it, we need to avoid the emission of 200 billion tons of carbon as we grow between now and then. So let's get to the wedges. Choose your favorite easy 8. Double fuel efficiency of 2 billion cars from 30 miles per gallon to 60 miles per gallon. Drive 2 billion cars only 5,000 miles per year rather than 10,000 at 30 miles per gallon. Raise efficiency at 1,600 large coal-fired plants from 40 to 60%. Replace 1,400 large coal-fired electric plants with natural gas-powered facilities. Install carbon capture and sequestration capacity at 800 large coal-fired plants so that the CO2 can be separated and stored underground. Install carbon capture and sequestration at new coal plants that would produce hydrogen for 1.5 billion hydrogen-powered vehicles. Install carbon capture and sequestration at 180 coal gasification plants. Add twice today's current global nuclear capacity to replace coal-based electricity. Increase wind power 40-fold to displace all coal-fired power. Increase solar power 700-fold to displace all coal-fired power. Increase wind power 80-fold to make hydrogen for clean cars. Drive 2 billion cars on ethanol using 1/6 of the world's cropland to grow the needed corn. Halt all cutting and burning of forests. Adopt conservation tillage. Cut electricity use in homes, offices, and stores by 25%. And cut carbon emissions by the same amount. If the world managed to take just one of those steps, it would be a miracle. 8 would be the miracle of miracles, but this is the scale of what will be required. There has never been a deliberate industrial project in history as big as this, Pakala said. Through a combination of clean power technology and conservation, we have to get rid of 200 billion tons of carbon over the next 50 years and still keep growing. It is possible to accomplish this if we start